Hello and welcome to the Substance of Life Experience podcast. Glad you could join us today. And as I always tell my listeners, I want a little bit of your precious undivided time. I always ask that you find a quiet space and get yourself that favorite beverage, be it an adult beverage or something that is just delectable in your eyes. And give me a few moments of your time. Today's subject is one that I am extremely excited about and wanted to do a podcast on it for quite some time, but was looking for just the right individual to lead us down the track. And I found Miss Tashonda Vincent Lee. And she is going to enlighten and educate us on the topic of cannabis. So, and Tashonda, I am so glad you could join us today and elevate our listeners on the topic of cannabis. It is a very, very diverse topic, and there are many areas that we could discuss. So we may have to do this again. So with that, I would like for you to introduce yourself to our listeners. Tell us a little bit about you.
Yes. Well, thank you so much, first and foremost, for having me, Angela. It's an absolute honor and a pleasure to be here with you and to be a guest amongst your Substance of Life Experience podcast listeners. My name is Tashonda Vincent Lee. And I am a working professional. I have been involved in the cannabis industry professionally since 2016. It was sort of a very roundabout way to become an advocate and an activist and eventually an actual employee of an MSO, which is a multi-state operator out of Massachusetts. So it has been a long road full of adventures, a lot of work, a lot of innovation, old-fashioned ingenuity, and just really hard work, to be quite honest. So I come to cannabis first and foremost as a patient. I'm actually a medical patient. I was prescribed cannabis once I moved to Massachusetts. So, backstory, I'm born and raised in the DMV area.
Okay.
So I'm a D.C., Maryland, Virginia girl.
All right.
Yes. I moved to North Carolina, lived in North Carolina for 7 years. At that time, I was actually diagnosed with depression, PTSD, as well as ADHD. I was prescribed psychotropics. And basically what I can share with you is just sort of, just a downward spiral, honestly, of my overall health.
But that's the norm. You know, that is the norm. Your physicians will subscribe things that really are not good for your mental and physical health.
Correct.
So,
it's interesting because even when we're talking about just like healthcare in general and the general disparities that exist, one thing that I noticed was one, it's not common as far as people of color goes. There's not many of us who are actively involved in seeking mental and behavioral support.
That's true.
But for those of us who do and do have the wherewithal, moreover, so the majority of my professional background is actually in mental and behavioral health. So ironically, I've done substance abuse counseling, as well as I worked for CSOSA, which is the Court Services and Supervision Offender Agency, which is a federal program for individuals who have basically a long-running drug-related crime history. And so they worked with this particular program is in D.C., where if they had a history of drug-related offenses, they were able to attend a 28-day program where they were able to receive addiction counseling, as well as just general overall life skills, coaching, and et cetera, and were set up pretty much for just a transition in a returning citizen state. So that was sort of my initial introduction to substance abuse and then counseling. And then when I was in North Carolina, I was actually a case manager. So I worked with pregnant women in substance abuse for a program called Hope Meadows. So with that program, what happened was we had women who, again, had just a long-standing drug history and who, for whatever reason, during their pregnancies at some point tested positive. So what they were able to do was they were actually able to come and live with us on campus for 1 year. And that's where we taught them life skills. We taught them parenting skills. We did addiction and counseling services, everything you could think of to just basically rehabilitate the entire person. It was a patient-centered program. And what I noticed, common thread, and this is prior to my own diagnosis, was that out of the majority of my experiences, I learned that it was not cannabis itself or drugs itself that did the majority of the harm, versus it was actually the legislation and the laws surrounding drug use that did the majority of the harm to these individuals. So preventing them based on their charges from certain professional employment opportunities, as well as access to advanced education, and et cetera. It just seems as if, in my opinion, I don't want to say the crime, but it's basically the life choice did not fit the punishment at all.
And that's very common in our community, in the African-American community. And for me, I've seen that date back to the 1960s, 1970s, 80s, 90s era. So yeah. I applaud you for being involved in that particular area and working with the underserved communities that are out there, especially pregnant women, because as you said, the education, I don't think that we were educated. We were told, you know, knowledge is power, and it just wasn't there. So moving full circle, you made the choice to use cannabis for medicinable reasons. So how did that come about?
Oh yeah. So fun story. I'm an 80s baby. So as you know, we're supposed to dare to be different. We're supposed to be above the influence. You know, this was our brain and this was our brain on drugs, and they wanted to know if we had any questions. So I definitely grew up sort of under the understanding that, you know, drugs were for the unproductive individual. Drugs were not for those who, again, were looking to be real go-getters, you know, have, I guess, pursue certain higher professional endeavors, et cetera. You didn't do that. So it was just something that I didn't necessarily want to touch as a younger child. Of course, I don't mind sharing being a teenager. I tried it recreationally. I can honestly tell you that I despised it. I thought I just didn't understand how people could consume this. It made no sense to me. It was something I didn't want to try again. Fast forward to, again, after I received my diagnosis, I'm in my late 20s, to be quite honest, so I'm probably between 26, 27. I'm living in North Carolina, and a couple of friends of mine, and believe it or not, I do have to say it was the environment that sort of opened my mind and changed my outlook on it. So when I was in North Carolina, I happened to have developed relationships and built relationships with, we're talking about attorneys, we're talking about law enforcement, we're talking about, you know, just all of those sort of pillars of our community and folks that we're taught to look up to. Well, something that I also realized is that these folks who were tasked with enforcing these laws in their own private time often had no issues with consumption.
Exactly. Absolutely. Absolutely.
So in my mind, I had an issue with reconciling, like, basically, how is it that you manage to penalize folks for consuming cannabis when you yourself do it? And in those conversations, again, you learn that, unfortunately, folks are just doing the job that they're tasked with doing. That doesn't necessarily mean that they believe in it, but it's their job and what they have to do. So for me, after seeing that, I was just like, hey, you know, all right, well, let me just give it a try. If you guys are doing it, you're professional, you're able to, you know, maintain and everything like that. Let me give
and
it
function,
try.
Yes.
Yes, yes. And when I did consume later, I must tell you that it completely changed my life from the very first time that I was able. And I do believe I microdosed. Just understanding, you know, now, again, the science behind it, of course, I'm much further ahead.
Mm-hmm.
But I it was a microdose instance, and I felt very clear. My emotions, I felt very balanced, meaning I didn't feel, with the depression, we know that sometimes there can be, like, extreme highs and lows, depending where you are. And basically, I just felt very even-keeled. I felt calm, cool, collected. I was crystal clear. I was like, there was no anxiety. And believe it or not, I sat down and I churned out a paper. It was just like,
now, see, it's interesting that you say that, because mm-hmm. I remember as I was growing up, I'm a Queens girl. I grew up in New York.
Okay.
And I had to take the bus to school, the city bus. We did not have the yellow school bus. But in okay. taking the city bus, we had a friend, and I don't know where this guy is right now, but his name is Sean.
Mm-hmm.
And every day, now this was back in the 80s, the early 80s, late 70s, Sean okay. would smoke a joint just before we got ready to get off the bus to go into the school.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm sitting there and I'm watching. I'm like, this dude smokes a joint every single day.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not understand why. But he did exhibit HDAD type of symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very hyper and he was very jittery. But then after he smoked that joint, he was really calm and he would go into class. And I think I had two classes with Sean.
Mm-hmm.
Sean had a 4.0, and no one knew it because we saw what we thought was who Sean was.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But Sean was a genius. He had a 4.0 average in high school
mm-hmm.
and mm-hmm. could get into any college that he wanted to because he had straight A's. And I don't know anybody who had straight A's throughout all 4 years of high school. I know I didn't. I'm going to just be honest. I know that I didn't. But he did. And, you know, the only thing that we saw coming to school every day was Sean was going to smoke a joint and he was going to get off the bus and go to class. But it mm-hmm. did bring him some sort of clarity. So I mm-hmm. think for me, and probably for a lot of people, we are uninformed as to the science of
okay.
this
okay.
herb. And I'm going to call it an herb because it's a plant. And
mm-hmm.
just like
mm-hmm.
you use your basil and your oregano, it's an herb. It's a plant. It is
mm-hmm.
from the earth.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't understand the science of it.
Right.
So,
well, what's unique is that we did understand the science. Maybe we weren't as advanced, but also remember that cannabis has been listed in the pharmacopoeia pretty much since the beginning of time. This is an ancient Chinese herb. This is BC. BC. Literally BC.
Hmm.
So when the pharmacopoeia was produced and published and went out initially, and we're talking 16th, which century was that? Don't quote me. I don't want to misquote.
No, that's okay. Because you know what? I always tell my listeners, if you hear something and you're not sure of it, you need to do your research.
Yes, but I would encourage you to look at the history of the pharmacopoeia, and you will find that cannabis, sativa, and indica has been listed for a very long time. Now, what happened was after Prohibition, the federal government got in contact with our higher institutions and actually had them pull all of the cannabis research and studies off of their shelves.
Wow.
Yes. So, no, we've been very aware, and not just as a nation, just as a global society, we've been aware of the healing properties for cannabis for a very long time. And if we want to fast forward, I mean, again, we can talk more about the science as far as the cannabinoids, entourage effect, endocannabinoid systems, and the like. I can definitely, I'd love to discuss that in detail. But just top line to understand that currently, current day, despite the federal one scheduling of cannabis, stating that there are no municipal benefits to this particular drug, and it shows that there is a high addiction rate, which we know it's not true because, again, cannabis is not physically addictive. It's not physically addictive. However, we do know addictive personalities are addictive personalities.
Exactly, and so they're going to find an excuse, yes.
Exactly. You can become addicted to sugar. You can become addicted to salt, like we know. But however, cannabis is not is non-toxic and is not physically addictive. But the U.S. currently holds a patent on cannabinoids. So U.S. 663-0507-B1 is actually the U.S. patent on cannabinoids as an antioxidant and a neuroprotectant.
You said neuroprotectant.
Neuroprotectant, yes. It's really good in degenerative diseases. We're talking about Alzheimer's. We're talking about Parkinson's, HIV, dementia. When we're talking about neurodegenerative diseases, cannabinoids are actually a great treatment because, again, they're a neuroprotective.
Interesting.
Yeah. And there's a U.S. patent on that, despite them saying there's no medical.
And see, and for me, it all boils down to, how can someone or a corporation or an entity make a nice profit off of this? And that's unfortunate.
Well, yes, and initially it was, unfortunately, the motivation behind cannabis prohibition itself were definitely racial. And that if we look at the history, we start with the FDN, which was headed by this wonderful individual, and yes, I am being facetious, Harry Anslinger, who was in charge of the FDN in the 1930s, which is when we
you gave an acronym. Tell our audience what that acronym means. You said the FDN.
Yeah, so the Federal Bureau of Narcotics.
Okay.
And that's actually before, we have our DEA, FDA, et cetera. So it was the Federal Bureau of Narcotics.
Okay.
And so basically he's on record stating that no, he could not make it illegal to be black and or Hispanic. However, he could take the vices that they use and or activities that they were most prone to and outlaw them.
Wow.
Which gave them a backdoor way to actually just, again, arrest them. and then you'll see that he had really concerted, targeted efforts after many of the blues and jazz musicians during that time.
Yes, because during that time, the community of jazz artists, it was well known that, you know, if you wanted, and back in the day they called it pot.
Mm-hmm.
If you wanted pot, you had to go down to places like the Village in New York because that's where the jazz musicians hung out at.
Right. So if you take a look at just some of the work that he's done, again, this makes me think of Hoover and et cetera. But for those folks who want to do a bit more research, just take a look at his efforts. And look at some of the things he did around Billie Holiday and et cetera. So
yes,
again, he didn't want her singing.
I don't want to interrupt you, but yes, I do. I am a Billie Holiday fan and know the life history and the story and all that was encompassed around who she really was. And yes, I recall the arrests that were around the drug addiction that she had, or the quote-unquote, I'm doing air quotes, drug addiction that she had, and the fact that she was an artist. So
correct.
You're bringing it all together for our listeners. And, you know, sometimes we hear facts, sometimes we don't know if it's fact or fable. But I think what you've just done is you've just opened up a window for us to see some of the reasons why some of these things occurred in some of the artists' lives the way that it did, in terms of the arrest and everything.
And correct. And then many of the folks in Key Players that you find that were affiliated with these particular bus, air quotes, you'll find that they were informants. So they very much infiltrated many of these artists' close circles and put informants in place to pretty much, I hate to say set them up, but I don't know how.
No, that there's no other term. They fessed up and said, hey, so-and-so is doing this, and probably
exactly.
got something in return for exposing what they saw.
Correct.
So, but I, you know, I look at that and I look at today and I say, wow, we have definitely, definitely made a turn, because today we've got a number of states that have legalized the recreational use and the medicinal use of cannabis, where it is legal in quite a few states in the United States. And I am very proud to say that the governor of the Commonwealth of Virginia, Ralph Northam, has introduced legislation to make cannabis legal in the Commonwealth for adults of the age of 21 and older. Now, I haven't seen any places where, you know, you might be able to purchase, like if you go to California, they've got billboards, they've got everything everywhere advertising it. I haven't seen that happen yet. I don't think the legislation has been signed. But I'm starting to see a trend towards a greater acceptance. And is that attributed to the science piece that has come out? Because there are more and more studies that are going on where cannabis is involved, and the pharmaceutical companies are starting to see the value and market appropriately.
I think there's a combination of variables, if you will, that are sort of lending to the popularity, if you will, of cannabis as an alternative therapy. I think that's where we are. I think that many people are, again, we're learning the harms of alcohol, right? Like, we're learning all of these things after the fact. We're learning about the dangers of tobacco. We're learning. And now we're just in a position, as you said, where the sort of we're reversing history, where now all of that scientific evidence is being brought to the forefront. And I think that that has everything to do with the age of innovation. I think that has everything to do with social media and et cetera, because now the dissemination of information is instant. There's no more, I remember growing up, the only way we could find information about things is the Encyclopedia Britannica. Like, that was the only way that you had, that really was Google.
Yes, that, and going to your public library, you know, living in New York, I graduated from going to my local library to taking the train and going to the library in the city, or Manhattan, as they call it today. Because they had a larger library, which means they had more information that I could look up and consume. And you're absolutely right. So technology has played a very, very big part of it. I want to take a break.